Hello, this is Matthew Bird. Just because I'm away this week does not mean that you get a week without me. This is my favorite topic of the semester, and I didn't want it to go undelivered. So I'm using modern technology to record it and bring it to you in your own home. It's short for me and full of some engaging videos, so I hope you've got a delicious home-cooked meal or your favorite ice cream and will enjoy my romp through efficiency and how the study of efficiency affected design. This week, instead of looking at objects and trying to understand the world those objects lived in terms of style or movement, I'm going to shift into a different gear and look instead at efficiency, how people started looking at work, the way we actually use our bodies and our machines to produce those objects. As we conquered manufacturing, the mere ability to make things and repeat as the big challenge gave way to a new challenge of doing that efficiently. At first, efficiency studies were developed to improve manufacturing. That new science was quickly applied to other arenas. Examining how efficiency study led to better design will take us into homes and revolutionize thinking about kitchens, about design, and about creating an opportunity for design to affect lives in new, exciting ways. This movie was produced by Frank Gilbreth, and there are more available on the History of ID YouTube channel. They're well worth watching. It's very interesting to see the before and afters and realize that with very small changes in setup, huge savings of effort could be achieved. Simply move the pile of parts to the right-hand side and pick them up as you transfer them instead of reaching across your body. So watch those films and look for the small changes they introduced and the dramatic savings in effort and time. Today I'd like to look at how that whole science of looking at work developed. In his Principles of Scientific Management, F.W. Taylor wrote, "We can see our forests vanishing, our water powers going to waste, our soil being carried by floods into the sea, and the end of our coal and our iron is in sight. But our larger wastes of human effort, which go on every day through such of our acts as are blundering, ill-directed, or inefficient, are less visible, less tangible, and are but vaguely appreciated." A few weeks ago, when we looked at the Industrial Revolution, the Arts and Crafts Movement, and the Art Nouveau period, we saw artists and designers starting to worry about the using up of the Earth's resources. Even back then, they were aware that we were being wasteful. What's fascinating to me is that F.W. Taylor is saying there are other wastes. It's not just the materials that we're wasting. If you do something in a foolish way, if you're not using your own energy efficiently, that's as much a waste as anything else. And that's an idea that you don't really hear before Taylor gives voice to it. We looked at the Industrial Revolution and how centuries-old methods of manufacturing were changed by the addition of power, harnessed from water and from coal, and how the ability to make larger and larger metal components led to larger and larger machines and a huge scaling up of manufacturing ability. The ability to make more caused a sort of manufacturing logjam, where the ability to produce and demand needed to be better connected. In this slide, you can see Denis Diderot's encyclopedia page that shows metalsmithing, and then below that, the picture I showed with the Industrial Revolution to show how hugely scaled up that system became, where the men were just holding the metal while this enormous machine did the hitting for them. And on the right is a picture from Detroit from the 1920s, and you can see that that scaling up continues. That's a press that makes leaf springs for cars with one small person operating the entire mechanism. If we're going to talk about efficiency, we have to start by looking at Henry Ford and how he changed the automobile industry, and as a result, all manufacturing in America, all industry in America, and also around the world. He filed over 161 patents in his lifetime, and as owner of the Ford Motor Company, he became one of the richest and best-known people, not just in America, but in the world. As a child, he was adept at operating his family's Westinghouse portable steam engine, and he ended up getting a job with Westinghouse as an apprentice machinist to work on their steam engines. The picture on the top is Ford driving his quadricycle to work. This is a car he made for himself to drive around in, and he must have been quite a sight. Ford's early interest in automobiles had more to do with speed. These are two early cars that he made, both designed for racing, both with the goal of setting new land speed records. The car on the left, for all you gearheads, was a 26 horsepower engine, and the car on the right, 80 horsepower. That's Henry Ford on the right, standing next to the car with somebody else driving. He was no fool. This car, with no windshield and no safety devices of any kind, must have been treacherous. But this car was able to set a new land speed record of over 91 miles per hour in 1902. That's really exciting. Ford's interest in automobiles didn't end there. By the age of 40, he was already on his third car company before he got the equation right. At the time, automobile manufacturers would purchase parts from all different suppliers and assemble them into an automobile. This is what Ford did. And within 3 months, his new company was on its feet and established and profitable. And that made Ford realize that there was a future for him in automobile manufacturing. It's interesting to note a few things about this first Ford mobile. It has a steering wheel. Most automobiles at the time had a tiller still. That's exciting. It had an 8-horsepower engine under that front bench. And the back seat is, you can see a seam, is an add-on. You could buy it as a 2-seater or a 4-seater. One thing about cars at the time is that they were very temperamental, very expensive, and really for the rich. If you were going to have a car, you probably also needed a mechanic slash chauffeur to take care of things when something went wrong. And Ford realized that if automobiles were going to really change the world, they needed to be affordable and reliable. And that's where the Model T takes over the narrative. The Model T, when introduced, cost $825. That's about $20,000 in today's money. It wasn't inexpensive, but it wasn't out of grasp for many people. This is the first automobile to be produced in large numbers and sold at a modest price. When you look at this picture, what is the first thing you see that's strange to you? Yes, you're right. The hammock is too high to get into without a stepladder. In addition to that, there's a dog in the front seat. There's a whole family in the car. You have to remember that before automobiles, our travel was limited to geography and transport method. You could take a train somewhere, but you had to go where that train went. If you were going overland, you had a horse or a carriage, and you had very limited options for where to go and when to go, and you had to plan well enough to get back. Having an automobile attached personal volition to travel. If you had a car that could go almost anywhere and could go 45 miles an hour and could run 25 miles on a gallon of gasoline, you could go visit grandma for the day. Families could live farther apart. You could live farther out in the country and still get to town. That's really going to change social structure, our approach to family, our approach to our jobs. All sorts of things will change. As an example, and also because I just like to promote this as a great story, my grandparents traveled in South America in the 1930s. They purchased a 20-year-old Model T and drove it around for well over a year. These cars were so ubiquitous and so tough that they were able to drive this anywhere they wanted to go. When the wheel broke, they just pitched a tent, waited for someone to drive by, sent the wheel into town, and it came back repaired the next day. When they ran out of gas, they figured out a way to rig a sail and sail it into town. That tells you what amazing adventurers my grandparents were, but in a bigger way, it tells you that adventure was possible for anyone. There were tools to take you where you wanted to go, however improbable. Everything you need to know about a Model T can be seen in this promotional movie. The whole family can get in and go off on an adventure. The Model T could drive on a dirt road. It could drive on a concrete road in the city. We'll see it driving in mud, in snowbanks, over cliffs. These cars were tough, and they could go anywhere. This video makes apparent two things. This is a really hardy beast, this car. But also, there are a whole bunch of other components that need to get sorted out if cars are going to really work. We looked at the turnpike construction of the 1820s as a tool around the world to promoting manufacturing and distribution. We're going to need another major upgrade if automobiles are going to be possible. One of the things we're going to need is a regular supply of gasoline, pipelines, and gas stations. It's interesting to note that at the beginning, there was no type for a gas station. As a result, we see gas stations in a dizzying, wonderful, exciting, terrifying range of styles. This was the realm of architects. Later, we're going to see how gas stations became the realm of industrial designers because we start to look at the systems involved. The prefabrication of the building, the pumps, the furniture inside. But right now, gas stations are novel and wonderful. I would love to buy my gas from a Chinese pagoda. This is a picture of the 10 millionth Model T on the left, and Henry Ford leaning on his original quadricycle over on the right there. The Model T was produced until 1927, and over 15 million of them were built. By 1918, half of all the cars in America were Model Ts. That's a lot of cars. If you remember when we talked about the American system of manufacturing and the division of labor and the rationalization of manufacturing into a series of operations where one person did one thing on a part and passed it on, that's still the way things are made at this time period. This is a picture of car manufacturing in 1900, and you can see workers at stations and the parts they're working on sort of getting passed from station to station. The Ford factory worked that same way. This picture shows you some rows of cars, and if you look carefully, you can see one row has gas tanks but no chassis, and the next row has chassis. Groups of cars would pass through and be constructed in this craft-based process. It isn't possible to manufacture as many cars as Ford did with this method. And that's where we get to the first important section of this conversation about efficiency. Ford introduced something that we now call Fordism. That's compartmentalized production and a moving assembly line. This is Ford before Fordism. And here's Ford with Fordism. Here are different sections of the Ford factory, and you can see overhead the moving parts. You can see in front of the workers the parts that move steadily past as they perform the operation they're supposed to be performing. This is a huge innovation with enormous implications for Ford, but for the whole automobile industry, and then anyone who ever mass manufactured after that. The moving assembly line improved chassis assembly from 12 hours and 8 minutes to 1 hour and 33 minutes. That's an amazing savings. It's also amazing that they measured it that carefully, and we'll come to that in a moment, the idea that things are measured in seconds at this point. Within 5 years, over 300,000 Model Ts were being made a year. That's more than all other car manufacturers combined. This is a great part. This guy is just ramming spokes into half of a wheel and another half of a wheel. And then the two halves of a wheel are sent somewhere else to be assembled into one wheel, and then they have a metal band put around two of them, and they're pressed together. Before 1906, the company had built fewer than 9,000 vehicles. The switch from 9,000 to 300,000 is astounding, and it is the moving assembly line that makes that possible. When you have that kind of scaling up of production, you have opportunities for economy of production, making things smarter, but also for better control over your profit. We looked at Wedgwood and his cost accounting systems, where he figured out how much every component of producing everything he made cost him so that he could better understand the profit margins. That's ever more possible when you scale things up. As a result, the price of a Model T Ford in 1916 dropped to $360, down from $825. How many things in your life are suddenly half the price they were last year? Almost none. As a result, sales increased to 472,000 cars. Remember, Ford's early efforts at car building required purchasing parts from other manufacturers and assembling them into a car. At this point, another component of how Ford is changing what he's doing is by introducing vertical manufacturing. It's a fancy term, but it's a simple idea. The raw materials arrive at the loading docks of the factory, and the cars go out of the front. All the components of the car are made in the factory. Another important component of what Ford introduced to manufacturing is something he called the wage motive. In 1914, he astonished everyone by voluntarily paying his workers $5 a day, which was more than twice what he had been paying them before. As a result, all of the best machinists in Detroit joined Ford and stayed at Ford. It was a very smart way to get the best people working for him and keep them. And that expertise could raise productivity and also lower costs in training and in keeping things running smoothly. Ford also introduced 6 8-hour workdays, making a 48-hour work week. That, to our ears, doesn't sound like any big deal, but the Fair Labor Standards Act in America wasn't legislated until 1938, and Ford was voluntarily, long before that, imposing some of those same guidelines for workload. Before the Model T, the American system, with its division of labors and regular, repeatable, interchangeable parts, was a pretty good way to make things, and we did it that way for 100 years. But manufacturing was still kind of a bumbling affair. After the Model T, we have Fordism, mass production of large numbers of inexpensive automobiles using this moving assembly line, inspired by a wage motive that kept people working effectively. Ford believed that an employee's motivation to work more is tied to receiving better wages. The next chapter in this roller coaster ride through efficiency involves a different method of increasing worker productivity. Frederick Taylor recognized that work could be systematically observed and studied and made more efficient, and that would increase output. The mere offer of more money left things up to the workers, when in fact the workers might not be the best people to decide how they should be doing their job. Taylor started as an apprentice industrial pattern maker and worked on the shop floor at a pump manufacturing company in Philadelphia. He later worked his way from machine shop laborer to gang boss to foreman to researcher to director and finally to chief engineer at Midvale Steelworks and moved on to Bethlehem Steel Yard. So he had a lot of experience on the floor and he really understood all aspects of manufacturing. In 1899, at Bethlehem Steel, Taylor applied scientific empiricism to what he was doing. Test things, analyze the results, change the test, in repeated iterations, without worrying about the limitations of conventional wisdom. And you all know when you do something you're not supposed to do, you either get in trouble or you get somewhere amazing. That's scientific empiricism. In Taylor's case, this led to the development of what we now call heat-treated steel alloys. The entire industry of cutting steel changed with the advent of heat-treated steel, which produced harder cutting surfaces. This innovation won Taylor a personal gold medal at the 1900 Paris Exposition. Over the course of his career, Taylor filed over 100 patents. Taylor realized that better production leads to cheaper goods, that cheaper goods lead to increased demand, that increased demand leads to more employment. When he started working in 1878, workers still learned their profession through years of apprenticeship, very much like we did in the Middle Ages. He introduced something called scientific management, and that system turned history upside down and broke every aspect of manufacturing into smaller elements that anyone could learn in a very short amount of time. We saw how Eli Terry and Chauncey Jerome did a similar thing in clock manufacturing in the 1820s and 30s. If you have someone who's only cutting gears over and over again, you can teach them just that one skill. It's easy to train them, and they'll be very effective at what they do. Taylor realized that you could determine how much a man can do not in the course of a day, and not in the course of 8 or 10 hours, but what a man could do in a fraction of a minute. With his partner, Henry Gant, Taylor developed tools to measure output, including what we call a time study, breaking a job into its separate components and measuring each of those components in a hundredth of a minute. We still call this kind of chart a Gantt chart. And this measuring led to the conclusion that there are 4 important phases of good management. First, introduce work methods based on scientific study of the task. Second, select and train in a scientific way each employee. Don't let them train themselves. And instruct. Workers should have detailed instructions for their specific task, and they should have regular supervision to make sure that that instruction is sticking. And last, separate managers from workers. There's this new level of employee that Taylor introduces called the manager, and managers plan the work using scientific principles and scientific evaluation, and then the workers perform the tasks as instructed. This is a movie produced to explain Taylor's idea. If you watch these men moving pig iron, they're sitting down every couple of trips up. Taylor realized that if you let workers work, they will work until they're exhausted. They'll work harder than they need to and burn themselves out quicker. If you enforce rest periods, take 3 or 4 trips and sit for 10 seconds, people will be able to work exponentially longer. Also, if you control the amount that they're lifting, instead of lifting as much as you can, just take 2. People are able to move much more because they don't wear out as quickly. The results of this study are stunning. In Taylor's pig iron carrying experiment, workers without a rest period, the way they had been working before, could move 12.5 tons per day and were paid $1.15. Aren't you glad you weren't working there then? After Taylor's study, with rest periods that were properly spaced, the same workers could move 54 tons a day and be paid $1.85. I think anybody looking at those numbers could understand that the workers are going to be thrilled that they're getting so much more money, but the business owners are going to be really excited that they're increasing their output 400-fold. In his Principles of Scientific Management, Taylor wrote, "For a first-class shoveler, there is a given shovel load at which he will do his biggest day's work. What is this shovel load? Will a first-class man do more work per day with a shovel load of 5 pounds, 10 pounds, 15 pounds, 20, 25, 30, or 40 pounds? This is a question which can be answered only through carefully made experiments. It was found that a first-class man would do his biggest day's work with a shovel load of about 21 pounds. This man would shovel a larger tonnage per day with a 21-pound load than with a 24-pound load, or than with an 18-pound load on his shovel." That's not a statistic anyone could have guessed at. By examining the work and keeping careful records, Taylor found the ideal amount of weight. And the next challenge, this is where it gets exciting for designers, was to design tools that enforced that standard. If someone's shoveling coal or pig iron, which is heavy, you need a pointed shovel with a shorter handle that held a relatively small amount because the material being shoveled was heavy. If that worker were shoveling ash, which is light, they would need a large shovel with sidewalls so that they could contain 21 pounds of ash. We saw that the Shakers had the same approach to tool design, but this is the first time we see that kind of thinking being applied on a large scale in industry. In Taylor's revised system, when workers arrived at work for the day, they were given a slip that told them where to report to pick up their tools and to which manager they would be reporting for the day. If at the end of the day they had not met the quota set for them, they were reassigned or retrained, and if they continued to fall under quota, they were given a pink slip, which meant please don't come back. That's where the term pink slip comes from. You could imagine that factory owners were nervous about Taylor's proposal that they add a whole new layer of management. But if you look at the numbers under the old plan at Bethlehem Steel, 400 to 600 workers moved 16 tons per man per day, were paid $1.15 each, and so the cost to handle 1 ton was 7 cents. In the new plan, it only took 140 workers to move 59 tons per man per day, and you paid them $1.88, which still kept the cost to handle that ton under half at 3 cents. That's an annual savings of $75,000 to $80,000. And Taylor was confident in saying the huge increase in productivity more than pays for the predominance of men with stopwatches and clipboards. And Taylor felt that because the workers were making sometimes twice as much, that this system benefited the workers as well. As we see the world of manufacturing transformed, you can imagine that there was some concern and criticism. When we looked at the Industrial Revolution and the Arts and Crafts movement, we saw a lot of conversation about the distinction between man and machine. If I work at a machine all day and I'm not using my brain in any way, am I any better than the machine? If I'm purchasing things that are made by machine, am I not part of this problem? The best example of this concern in the 1930s is Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. I'm giving you a very, very short section of this so that you can see the inevitable, which is that Charlie Chaplin is so overwhelmed by his work at the machine that he eventually goes insane and becomes part of the actual machine. There are some interesting advances that come along with the advance of scientific management. What we now know as IBM started out as the International Time Recording Company, a company established to make recording devices, not clocks that measured a day or an hour, but clocks that measured minutes and seconds, devices for workers to clock in and clock out so you could measure their comings and goings. The symbol of Taylorism is the stopwatch. That's what was required to make the system work. This is an illustration from his big monograph, The Principles of Scientific Management, which was published in 1911. And you can see it's a sketchbook with two areas for stopwatches concealed inside so that managers could more effectively monitor their workers. We still live in a world that is the result of Taylorism. If any of you have worked at a McDonald's, they tell you not just how much time to cook the hamburger, but how much time it takes to put that hamburger on the bun. That idea of dividing tasks into ever smaller bits is part of our world. Not just in auto plants, but even firefighting companies that use Taylor's theories to reduce response time. If the symbol of Taylorism is the stopwatch, that's because Taylor was primarily concerned with reducing process times. The next chapter in looking at efficiency involves Frank and Lillian Gilbreth. They had a very different concern because they saw that the health of the worker was not the result of giving him more money. The health of the worker was the result of giving the worker work that was satisfying to accomplish. Frank had no formal education beyond high school. He began his career as a bricklayer and became a building contractor. He was an inventor, and he evolved into a management engineer. Lillian was one of the first working female engineers in America with a PhD from Brown University. And they believed that poorly planned jobs made work tiresome and destroyed the enjoyment of the task for the worker. They believed that employees deserve basic human dignity, and the best way to get to that is by having the satisfaction of using your skills. And they believed that standardized work could also be skilled work. That you're at a factory doing the same thing all day doesn't mean that your soul and your spirit can't be part of what you're doing. The Gilbreths are best known today for a book called Cheaper by the Dozen, which two of their 12 children wrote about the insanity and hilarity of growing up in a family run by management experts. When Frank started his career as a bricklayer, he realized that this profession, a 2,000-year-old profession, had not ever changed. He found a work environment where bricks and mortar were on the ground, bricks were in a random pile, and to install a brick, a 200-pound man would bend down, pick up the brick, examine it to determine which side should face out, bend down to pick up mortar, put the mortar on the brick, and install the brick. So that 200-pound man, to set one brick in place, is lifting 400 pounds. He realized that was a very inefficient way to do things, and proposed some very simple changes that really changed bricklaying. He also designed a new kind of scaffold. The Gilbreth scaffold was loaded with pre-inspected bricks that were stacked with the right side facing the same direction. The scaffold had a work surface at the installation height, so that you didn't need to stoop over it. The mortar was at the height you would be using it, and the bricks were at the height you would be installing them. And that whole scaffold lifted up on stilts, so your work surface moved up with the building. Gilbreth taught bricklayers to pick up a brick with the left hand only, while picking up a trowel full of mortar with the right hand only. He substituted a deeper mortar box for the mortar board that had been used before. And then he put the mortar box and the brick pile close together at the proper height with this new scaffold. All of those things seem like obvious no-brainers to us. But the result of carefully looking at relocating the objects that were being used in this system led to an enormous increase in efficiency. One man in 1 hour could increase the number of bricks he could lay from 120 to 350, with the only change being relocation of components. If you add to Frank's engineering know-how Lillian's understanding of psychology, you get a really exciting team. As a team, they taught managers that every aspect of a workplace should be regularly questioned, improvements should be regularly adopted. The Gilbreths pioneered the use of photography in analyzing motion in time. Remember that Taylor introduced the time study, break down a job into all of the components and measure the time they take. The Gilbreths are proposing something radically different and, to my brain, more exciting. which is that you can examine the movements that are taking place in any system and renegotiate those. Not just measure the time, measure the movement. And that's what we now call a motion study. Subjects in their studies would wear lights attached to their fingers that left tracings on multiple exposure still photographs. The light path turned into then a three-dimensional record of the movements that were executed, and the Gilberts could study those movements and eliminate the wasted motion. They also recorded their subjects using motion picture cameras, an early use of motion picture camera as a research tool. And what they would do is find the worker in the production line that was more productive than others, study them, understand why that worker was doing something more efficient than other workers. Through the result of their studies, they could build training models. On this slide on the right are pictures of some training models that they called 3D motion models, and they worked very much like the children's toys with wire and colored beads that helped children develop motor skills. Somebody could run their hands over this series of shaped wires and understand which orientation their hands should have to better perform the task they were learning. The Gilberts studied many different industries and transformed them in many ways. We still see a lot of their transformations in action. The term caddy in an operating room was introduced by Frank Gilbreth. The idea that the surgeon would do the surgery and a caddy nurse would hand the surgeon the tools is something that the Gilberts introduced as a result of studying the inefficiencies of surgery. They also made training films that were used by armies around the world to teach recruits how to rapidly disassemble and reassemble their weapons, even when blindfolded or in total darkness, by learning the motions involved, and that training system is still used today. In 1908, the Gilberts introduced Thirblings. That's just Gilberth backwards, and it's a silly name for a really wonderful idea. They're symbols that identify movement. By attaching those symbols to something they called a SIMO chart, a simultaneous motion chart, they were able to chart the sequence of motion that every hand produced in an activity. And then by examining the charts, they could determine which Thirblings were taking too long or which could be eliminated by rearranging the work. They could also identify periods of delay that were caused by a tool or a bad layout and renegotiate the system. Again, it may seem like an obvious idea, but the math that they provided pointed out that if you could identify three motions in some manufacturing process that you could shave down by 2 seconds each, you save 6 seconds. If those motions are done 500 times a day, that's 50 minutes a day. If you've got 5 workdays a week, that's over 4 hours a week you're saving. If you have 5 people doing that job, it's 20 hours. These tiny savings accrue into enormous savings, and that's going to be very exciting and appealing to a manufacturer. This is Margaret Owen, the world's fastest typist. And remember, this is before electric typewriters. Manual typewriters required enormous finger strength. And when Margaret Owen became the world's fastest typist, she was able to type 136 words per minute in 1913. The Gilberts worked with her and recorded her motion and applied Thirblings to their SIMO charts. And by the end of the process in 1918, Margaret Owen was able to type 170 words per minute. So up from 136 to 170. The Gilberts applied their process to all sorts of different motions. After World War I, many war veterans were scarred by the war emotionally and physically. Many people were disabled and returned unable to perform the jobs they had left to go to war. The Gilberts worked with many different industries to figure out how to get those workers back at their jobs. These are two gentlemen the Gilberts worked with who lost limbs. They designed new typewriters and renegotiated the office desk so that these gentlemen could still function with just one arm. Frank died in 1924, and Lillian took over the business and lived for another 50 years and worked all the way to the end. She focused her work on taking the Gilbreth systems and applying them to the home. She served as an advisor to Presidents Hoover, Roosevelt, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. That's a lot of presidents. She worked on civil defense, on war production, on rehabilitation of physically handicapped. There was a polio epidemic in America in 1950, and many housewives and mothers were stricken by polio and couldn't keep their houses operating, Lillian used the Gilbert system of observation to train women how to continue running their houses. In 1930, the New York Herald Tribune built a model home, and Lillian Gilbert designed the kitchen. She proposed some very important ideas that are still with us. The idea of circular motion in a kitchen, or anywhere, that if you're moving back and forth in a linear way, you're wasting energy. If you can arrange your components so that you're constantly moving, it's more efficient. With this kitchen redesign, she introduced the Kitchen Practical, which is a corner office featuring a radio, a telephone, a bill-paying station. It's a home office in the kitchen where it would be most needed. And that project led to the Gilbert Management Desk, which was manufactured by IBM and on view at the Chicago World's Fair in 1933. The Gilbert's mantra was make visible the invisible. Movement is something that very few people had thought about quantifying before the Gilbert's, and it's an enormous part of how industrial designers work now. If you don't understand how a body moves, you can't design for that body. And if you don't understand how people's brains tell their bodies to move, you're going to end up with inefficiencies. The Gilberts were a perfect combination of skill and temperament to identify and promote this gospel of efficiency. I'd like to continue by looking at how Lillian's transfer of efficiency study to the kitchen gets us to the next era of efficiency studies. But first, we need to look a little bit at what kitchens were like so that you can understand how dramatic this transformation was. Here's a small tangent to look at what's going on with kitchens. They were badly in need of attention. In 1900, families had ice boxes and purchased ice to keep their food cold. The ice box was not in the kitchen. It was usually on the back porch or in the hallway near the back door so that the iceman who delivered the ice and the milkman who delivered the milk wouldn't have to walk through the entire house. With the advent of electricity, we start to see electric appliances everywhere, and that really changed refrigerators. The introduction of the GE Monitor Top refrigerator in 1929 was so exciting that the saleswoman, seen in this picture, is presenting it coming out of a treasure chest. And the sales slogan for this campaign was, "Making it safe to be hungry." All aspects of kitchen equipment developed in this time period, but in a very stilted way. We're not talking about what we think of as modern equipment. Stoves hadn't changed very much since cast iron allowed cooking to move out of the hearth. In 1851, there were gas stoves shown at the Crystal Palace Exposition, but that wasn't really very practical until people actually had gas in their homes, and that didn't happen until the 1880s. In 1893, an electric stove was shown at the Chicago World's Fair, but that wasn't really practical until the 1930s when people had electricity in their homes. So for a very long time, coal and wood were our best options for stoves. If you look at irons, it's a similar story. For centuries, an iron was just a hunk of metal that we heated up by putting in a fire or on a fire, or later putting hot coals inside the hunk of metal. In 1882, the Seeley iron introduced electricity by just putting wires on a contact, so the whole thing was just sort of live. Before that, irons had liquid gas. You spray gas across a flame to heat it up. These are incredibly crude. In the 1920s, we see the advent of the thermostat, which allows an electric iron to be controllable. Electricity also allows a vacuum cleaner into the home. In 1908, the Hoover vacuum cleaner weighed 40 pounds. Don't you feel sorry for this woman who is about to run her vacuum cleaner into the staircase and then realize that she's got a 40-pound vacuum cleaner she's got to lug upstairs? Anyone looking for women in design might want to look at Josephine Cochran. She's a really interesting woman, and she designed the first dishwasher. She was a wealthy housewife from Shelby, Illinois, who patented her dishwasher in 1886 and showed it at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. It was such an enormous, cumbersome monster of a thing that it really was only practical for hotels and restaurants. That company eventually became KitchenAid and Whirlpool. If we look at dishwashers for decades after, they're not that much more sophisticated. This 1929 dishwasher is just a huge drum with a motor at the bottom that spins water around the dishes. Most dishwashers were a container and a motor. In 1954, this countertop model drained itself into the sink, but that's a far cry from what we think of as a dishwasher. In 1900, kitchens looked much as they had for almost 100 years. There were new technologies, but they all were incorporated in a piecemeal way. The environment of the kitchen had never received any design or any study. The best a woman could hope for is something like a Hoosier cabinet. This is a piece of furniture designed to centralize activity and equipment. So it's a lot better than an unconsidered kitchen, but it's still a piece of furniture, not a room. It introduced some great ideas. The flour is built right in above its sifter. There's a pull-out cutting board. All of the tools you need and the spices you need are right there available. And that's a big step forward. Other companies learned from the success of Hoosier and made more finished decorative versions. There had been many other attempts to shed light on the problem of kitchen non-design. The earliest and probably the most famous is Catherine Beecher's. Her stove, seen on the right, proposes some really interesting innovations. There's a water reservoir around the chimney, so the heat from the chimney smoke is absorbed by the water and you have pre-warmed water. The heating chamber has attachments that can be added for rotisserie, for different seasonal cooking. Beecher's treatise was the first written document in America that collected in one source all the information a woman might need to run a household. Beecher was frustrated that women were taught few practical skills if they were educated, and even more frustrated how few women were educated at all. Her life's work was better education for women, believing that because women were largely responsible for educating and forming children, it was women who were forming our country, and yet we were not thanking them by making their lives easier. How we get back to scientific management and efficiency is through the graces of Christine Frederick. Christine Frederick is a housewife from Long Island who applied the lessons of scientific management to the operation of the household. She created and advanced the field of household efficiency and promoted home economics and consumer marketing. She worked out of the Applecroft Home Experiment Station, also known as her kitchen, on Long Island, and introduced many ideas that are crucial to kitchen design now: standardized height of kitchen counters and work surfaces,
and thinking about a kitchen not as architecture or space, but as a system.
She lectured extensively. She was contributing editor for Ladies' Home Journal, The Designer, Shrine, The American Weekly, a number of publications. Between 1912 and 1948, she wrote several books on household management and the role of women as consumers. She also worked with industry extensively. This slide shows you her relationship with the Hoosier Manufacturing Company. If you send the coupon in to Hoosier, you'll get a copy of her book. In 1915, Christine Frederick wrote Scientific Management of the Home. Listen to the title of that book, Scientific Management of the Home. And it's published just 4 years after Taylor's book. The idea that someone is taking those new ideas about industry and applying them to the home is radical. I'd like to read this quotation to you. Usually, after our dinner, I wash 48 pieces of china, 22 pieces of silver, and 10 utensils and pots, or 80 pieces in all. And for years, I never realized that I actually made 80 wrong motions in the washing alone, not counting others in the sorting, wiping, and laying away. Like all other women, I thought that there couldn't be much improvement in the same old task of washing dishes. It took me 45 minutes to scrape, wash, and dry those 80 dishes by using wrong methods. Now I wash the same number of pieces in 30 minutes, or a gain of 15 minutes. I wanted to read that because it sounds clumsy and it sounds folksy, and that's intentional. Her writing style is very accessible to people who would be reading her book. And yet she's introducing the same sort of language that Taylor used. It sounds scientific, it's using numbers, it's comparing befores and afters in a way that would get anyone excited about how they might apply this thinking to their own lives. Christine Frederick also wrote, "The small kitchen costs less to build, but even more important to the worker, the small kitchen saves steps by concentrating the working process." Over the course of her career, she investigated almost 2,000 different products, from household appliances to food, and wrote reviews of them. Here's a passage from Household Engineering. "I measured the height of the bottom of my sink from the floor and found it was only 24 inches. The sink basin was only 5 1/4 inches deep. That is why the water slopped over the pan and over the edge of the sink. Besides, our builder had carefully planned a dish closet over the sink at the exact height to strike the top of my head when I bobbed it up from my work. Frederick measured women of different heights to find the right sink height, and she discovered that for every 5 inches difference in a woman's height, there should be a change of 2 1/2 inches in the sink, or the table, or the ironing board. This is thinking that's very familiar to industrial designers. Ergonometrics, or the measuring of people, is part of every good design project. At the time, it wasn't something people thought about. And here's Christine Frederick in 1915 using that science. Her magnum opus, Selling Mrs. Consumer, came out in 1929, and it's a fascinating source of information about what consumers cared about and how they could be appealed to. It's a huge amount of data about domestic and gender-based consumption produced by Frederick with Columbia University. It was a study there that she assisted. Look at the title of Chapter 5, Feminine Instincts and Buying Psychology. That's very forward-thinking information. So Christine Frederick started American Women, and as a result, America, down this path towards a domestic interior that balances home and workshop, where a kitchen can be attractive, but also works well. There are counters instead of separate pieces of furniture, and countertops at the correct height. There are drain boards draining directly into sinks. There are pantries and refrigerators in places where you need to use them. Any conversation about using design to improve a kitchen must lead you to the Frankfurt kitchen. The Frankfurt kitchen was a milestone in domestic architecture. It's the forerunner of our modern fitted kitchens. It's the first unified concept in kitchen design, where all of the components are made at once in service of the overall design. And that design was created to support efficiency. It was built at low cost. It was designed in 1926 by the Austrian architect Greta Schuder-Lahotsky for a housing project in Frankfurt, Germany. Over 10,000 units were built in the late 1920s in Frankfurt. Frankfurt was very scarred by World War I, and there was a great demand for quick, low-cost housing. This is a picture of the Frankfurt kitchen that's been recently reinstalled at the MoMA in New York, and the workflow chart that Schuder-Lahotsky created to better understand how a kitchen was used and how the renegotiating of those locations could lead to a more efficient kitchen. You see Lillian Gilbreth's circular flow, and you see everything that Christine Frederick wrote about. That's not accidental. Schuder-Lahotsky was aware of Christine Frederick's writing. Christine Frederick had lectured in Germany as well, and she incorporated all of that information into the design of the Frankfurt kitchen. When you look at the Frankfurt kitchen, you recognize the modern age. Here we are in the modern era, where design includes an understanding of use. Next week, we'll go back to looking at objects. We'll look at the Art Deco as a style and understand why things look the way they do because of the time they were created. We'll also look at the birth of the profession of industrial design and lots of beautiful objects. But I wanted to pause for a moment to look at this chapter of inspiring advances in manufacturing and in understanding human bodies and brains, because it's such a big part of what the profession of industrial design grows to include, and it didn't happen slowly or accidentally. It happened in a very focused, intentional way because of the work of some really fascinating people. I hope you'll take the time to watch this video on YouTube. The link is listed below, because it's one of the greatest examples of history-inspiring art. It's an entire song about the Frankfurt kitchen.
This is my tribute to the Frankfurt kitchen. This is my salute to great Schuder-Lahotsky, to the perfect fusion, the form and function, to the short screw from Lada, to worktop, to cupboard, to cutlery drawer, to worktop, to bin. That's the point.